Welcome to the World Soccer Talk pod at World Soccer Talk, hashtag WSTP pod. Subscribe via Stitcher, TuneIn and iTunes. Yes, I thought I'd get the business out of the way early doors because there's just so much to talk about. And with all the excitement, I often forget the business side of proceedings. I'm joined by the Ace Crack team, the A-team. Should we call them the A-team? What does that make you, Kartik Karashnaya? Are you Mr. T?
Maybe I'm Mr. E. I don't. I'm not Mr. T.
Nate Aburaya is definitely the face, though. Where can people find the face?
At DarthNater99. I think we should just call Kartik Mr. T for the rest of the show. He is officially Mr. T. And this is great because we have the team full of Yanks. So how fitting is it that we're the A-team right now? And I'm always inspired by our good friend Robin Burt, who is MIA for this episode.
Chardonnay.
The Chardonnay is getting to him. And so Birdie oftentimes will go disappearing for full episodes. So forgive me if I do that because I want to be like Birdie when I grow up. And I've got this... I've got this Mexican League final going on over here. So I've got one eye on America and Tigres, tied at one on the Marcador Global here in the second half.
I thought you were celebrating.
Some of us grew up in the 1980s, so we are A-team fans.
Beautiful.
I thought you were celebrating your birthday. Weren't you meant to be hammered?
Oh, I celebrated my birthday all weekend, and then Liverpool gave me a really nice birthday weekend gift this morning. Are we going to talk about that?
Yeah, maybe. What's your Twitter handle, Kartik? Kartik? Did we lose Kartik?
I'm here. KKFLA737.
Oh, you know what Kartik does? He thinks he's so cool that he just like mutes his volume so he can swear at us so nobody hears and then actually forgets to turn it back on. Kartik, right. Keep the volume on.
You don't want the explicit tag on this pod, though, do you?
No. Never. Now, we can't forget the third man. And being that I didn't grow up in America during the 80s and didn't really follow the A-team, I only know the face and Mr. T. So what is the stat man?
You're asking me? That show is well before my time, and I wasn't even living in this country then. So I don't even get the reference at all. But
That's nice getting crickets in return. I mean, Kartik, you're pretty ancient, although probably not as old as me.
If I remembered anybody but Mr. T, I would be an A-team junkie, and I'm not. So.
Oh, Nate, help us out here with these buffoons.
Isn't there a Barack's? Something like that? Barack's?
Barack's. Barack's. What is he, a sausage or something?
Candy? Rock's candy?
You guys are...
Well, there was Howling Mad Murdoch. He was one of my favorites.
Yeah, they're Murdoch. Thank you. Okay, so Stats Murdoch. Stat, what's your Twitter handle?
At Statman Mossy, M-O-S-S-E. And speaking of Mexican soccer, I am now knee-deep in the Club World Cup. We've got Cruz Azul against Real Madrid on Tuesday. Get fired up.
La Máquina!
Yeah. And who are the entrants from Asia? The Dog and Duck 11?
The Western Sydney Wanderers, Australian team. They fell already to Cruz Azul. The semifinals are Real Madrid, Cruz Azul, and San Lorenzo against Auckland City of New Zealand.
Well, it's fantastic. We have the World Championship of Club Football going on, and nobody has a clue who has even been in this tournament or played a game.
Real Madrid, by the way, is my pick to win this competition.
Oh, really going out on a limb there, Statman.
Stump the stat, man. I got the Máquina. I got Cruz Azul. Come on.
All right, let's get down to business. Sod the FIFA World Club Cup and sod the Liga Mexicana Championship. We are all about the Premiership. And there was a great scene in a movie, Poltergeist. I don't know if you're familiar with it. And the little girl, she's sitting at the TV and everything's gone really kind of fuzzy. And her mum comes in and the mum goes, "Hey, little darling, are you all right?" And the little girl goes, "They're back." Who could we be talking about? They're back. Just a few points off second place. They're back. Just 8 points off the title. They're back. Manchester United.
The ghosts of Old Trafford.
Manchester United. And I love the fact that they unfurled a banner just before kickoff. What did it read? 24 years and counting. Ooh, that monk wit. It's razor sharp. Well, it was razor sharp as they gave Liverpool. And I predicted, actually, that Man United would stroll out easy winners in this one because Liverpool couldn't score in a brothel. And Mr. Daniel Sturridge, he'll be... Raheem Sterling will be having nightmares about this particular one as he could have quite easily had three or four. But what a performance by Manchester United. They're not playing very well, but they are winning games and they are cruising up the table. And could it be said that Manchester United have found their mojo? We'll have to start with the stat man. How on earth did United win this game? And we'll get to Brendan Rodgers with Nate Aborea after you.
Well, yeah, it's become a kind of a bizarre season for Man United because the results are much better than the performances. And I thought that again today, although I thought they got better as the game wore on and second half played fairly well. But still, not to win 3-0. I mean, the chances were about even in this game. And but no, I mean, they have one thing they have that they can lean on. I've mentioned this in the podcast before, and I'll say it again. They have the second best goalkeeper in the world now behind Manuel Neuer and David De Gea. I really believe he's at that level now, certainly the best in the Premier League. And so that's a good place to start. You know, with all the changes they've had at the back, they know they can at least lean on their goalkeeper. And then from the midfield up, they have all these match winners now because they've spent so much money there that, you know, even when they're not playing well, you know, a Rooney can still pop up and make a play, a Van Persie, a Di Maria, who I know didn't play today, a Mata. So they do have a lot of quality going forward, and De Gea back there. So, you know, as long as they get decent enough play from that back line, I mean, they are all of a sudden a team that's difficult to beat.
Kartik, RVP, back in the goals, seemingly relishing life again after looking like a pub player not more than 3 weeks ago. What do you put down his resurgence to?
Couple of things. One, I think the combination with Rooney is working up top. Rooney back at that forward position, although he dropped back into midfield when Falcao came on. And also competition from Falcao. He's been pushed. There was a lot of talk about Van Persie once again being off the pace, once again getting injured at the wrong times, potentially getting injured at the wrong times. And, of course, United has had so many injuries this season. But Van Persie is Johnny on the spot. He can create his own shot. He also can poach a goal. And he's become lethal on the counterattack. And that was something Robin Van Persie did not have in his game at Arsenal. He wasn't a particularly good counterattacking player, probably because Arsenal wasn't a good counterattacking team. But that clincher today, that third goal, great classic counterattacking goal. And that was the match there in the 70th minute or 71st
Kartik,
minute.
It was rather assisted by the most buffoonish, clownish defending I have seen in quite a long
very
time.
Good point.
How does Lovren claim to be a Premiership player? I have no idea. Nate Aburea, Betfair makes Brendan Rodgers the second favorite in the sack race. This is the man who was voted Manager of the Year back in May. Obviously, not a very clever 7 days for Liverpool. You and I were texting back and forth during that shameful exit from the Champions League, because that's the only thing I could possibly describe it as. Where is Brendan Rodgers? Where does he go from here? Because surely the results right now are results that kind of get managers the sack.
You win the Europa League. That's what you do right now. I mean, that is the level of desperation that this club and that manager are at right now. But at the same time, when you live in the present moment and you look at this current situation, you look at the Premier League table and you see them sitting in 10th place at the bottom of the big bunch of parity right there. I mean, still 7 points off a Champions League spot with West Ham. But no, that's not going to happen. This team is going downhill fast. But the fact that there's the saving grace of putting all your eggs into the Europa League basket, and it's something that me and the Statman have talked about endlessly regarding the team right across Stanley Park over there with Roberto Martinez and Everton, which it seems as if all year they've kind of been doing that themselves. And the fact that there's this chance to get back in the Champions League by winning that, it is a long shot, but that's the situation of desperation that this club is in right now. I have enjoyed some of the rumors regarding the potential replacement going to the end of the year, and they would basically follow in the footsteps of the team that just pummeled them 3-0 in Manchester United when they went with Ryan Giggs replacing David Moyes last year. And the concept of Jamie Carragher coming back as the manager for the remainder of the season, that's one that's so intriguing that as a Liverpool supporter who hopes that Rodgers gets at least till the end of the year, I almost want to see that just as a pundit and a fan of entertainment, is seeing Kara on the sideline for the remainder of this disaster of a season.
Stat, looking at United, are they in the title race? I mean, obviously they're not that many points behind Chelsea. They're in an incredibly rich vein of form. As we've noted, they're not playing terribly well, but they keep on winning games. As we've noted, they have an horrific injury crisis in the back line, but they're still winning games. And their fixtures coming up seem fairly tame. Can they work their way back into this title race? Are they part of the equation, or is this just a mirage?
I think title is a bit of a stretch, but you know, they said top three was their goal heading into the season. I think they have a very good chance at that. They're solidly the third best team right now, and I would say Arsenal are the fourth best. So I think the top four is actually pretty defined right now. It's going to be Chelsea, City, United, and Arsenal. And you know, that to me would be a success for United to get back into the Champions League group stage next season. So anything beyond that is a bonus. I think, like you said, they're not playing that well. They've kind of ridden some pretty good luck here, and I think that's going to catch up to them eventually. They're not a great team this season. They're better than they were last year, but no, I mean, they're still 8 points behind Chelsea, who are clearly superior to them. So, no, I don't see them as being serious title contenders.
Kartik, at City, you've had your little goalkeeping. Who's number one? Who's number two? Mignolet was the fall guy. Is Brendan Rodgers looking for a way out with this erratic goalkeeper, or... I mean, the whole goalkeeping thing in the Premiership now, really, it smacks of NFL QB1, QB2 kind of talk.
Yeah.
Whereas back in the day, it would just be, well, you're rotating in, rotating out. I've never actually rated Brad Jones, and he's been a number two for a billion years for a very good reason. You know, it sounds like, you know, Liverpool have many, many problems. And when your manager is undecided about your number one goalkeeper, that would seem like a monster problem.
Yeah, I was surprised Mignolet has made mistakes this season. He's had a few howlers, as has every keeper in the league, with the exception of Courtois and De Gea. But I was surprised by this, scapegoating him after the Basel match, dropping him, bringing in Jones, who's played in spot duty at times behind Pepe Reina and now behind Mignolet the last few seasons. But I thought it was a bizarre decision, especially when you have some of the buys of Rodgers. Now, Mignolet was a Rodgers buy too, obviously, 2 summers ago, but some of these Rodgers buys, like Lovren, just not panning out at all. Dejan Lovren, we thought so highly of him a year ago at Southampton, but he has been perhaps the worst, single worst central defender on a team in the top half of the table this season. Maybe the worst central defender in the entire Premier League.
Oh, come on, what about Malanga? Come on. What about your boy at Man City?
Mangala has been poor, too.
Mangala, yeah, he's a disaster.
Malanga.
Malanga.
That's poor as Lovren.
Bambone.
Boom.
When Colo Torre is a better option, you're looking down your bench and you see Colo Torre is a better option, then you know you've wasted about $20 million in the transfer market.
Let's go to some tweets. Jake Cohen at Jake FC Cohen. This one's for you, Nate. John Henry plus FSG committed over £130 million this winter to improving the Red Sox squad. LFC is unlikely to see even one third of that investment come January. Is John Henry going, oh, dearie me, maybe I'm just going to put all my money into the stadium rather than to give Brendan Rodgers more money to squander?
I wouldn't blame him for thinking that right now, because say all you want about the situation with American owners who own multiple clubs around the world, whether it's a baseball team, a football team here in the States. Brendan Rodgers was given a nice little blank check this summer, and you talk all about Dejan Mustard Lovren over there. 65 million pounds between Lovren, Markovic, and Lallana, being the same collective pound amount that was spent on Costa and Fabregas at Chelsea. I point back to that stat so often when people say, oh, it's not fair that, you know, the Red Sox are out buying Pablo Sandoval and Liverpool's not going to get to go out and get anything here in January. Well, neither are a lot of other clubs, and Brendan Rodgers screwed the pooch on this one and had his chance. And so I'm not ready to start pointing the blame at the American owners and the let's not even get into the sale of Suarez and such, but various things that I've been hearing of late saying, oh, it's just not fair that Brendan can't go out and get rescued by something that he absolutely does not deserve. He's at the end of his wits, and he's not going to make it till the end of this year, and he has only himself to blame.
Kartik, Brendan Bate at Brendan 22340. There's an obvious mutual trust between LVG and his players. We have our team back. Is this someone getting a tad overly excited?
Yeah, I mean, how much better are Manchester United now under Louis van Gaal than they would have been under David Moyes at this point? And Moyes has been given the money to spend in the transfer window this summer that van Gaal has been given. I don't know that they would be much better. Their standout performers are still De Gea, who was a Fergie buy, one of the only good Fergie buys the last few seasons, by the way, that he was at Manchester United, Rooney and Van Persie. So I'm not quite sure that things would not be a whole lot different. Obviously, Van Gaal is great in the press. The media loves him. He's got a certain suave to him. The media wanted to beat up on David Moyes. So maybe they're getting more of a pass from the British press, from especially from the tabloids. But I don't know that Van Gaal has made that much of a difference, personally. I think Moyes got a bit of a raw deal from Manchester United supporters and from the press.
Oh, poor David Moyes. But he did get a 1-1 tie in the Basque derby today. Here's a quote for you. We are very good. We are in a very good way now, and I'm very happy with the players. I was very pleased today because we started to show the character we want. We are fighting in every situation, and we have a lot of good players and young talent. With time, we will improve even more. Any idea who said that? Crickets, I love it.
Rodgers.
That would be Mauricio Pochettino, the Argentinian manager of Spurs, who claimed he did not understand the English phrase smash and grab. And Spurs on the road, and Spurs, in fact, in general recently, have been smash-and-grab experts. 2-1, their favoured scoreline. And they seem to be in the habit of grabbing these late winners and saving Pochettino's neck as they took care of Swansea. I know the gaffer, our beloved boss, was probably crying in his leek soup at around 10 o'clock this morning, Pacific time, as Christian Eriksen popped up out of nowhere to score yet another vital goal. Boney, yet again, proving that he is the best goal scorer in the Premiership. I believe he has the most goals and most involvement in goals in a calendar year. Would that be right, Statman?
Yeah, I haven't kept up with that stat for a couple of weeks, but yeah, there was a stat that popped up a couple of weeks ago that in terms of Premier League goals this calendar year, he was right up there with Aguero. They were the top two.
Tottenham Hotspur, Harry Kane once again popping up, coming to the rescue with a pretty meaty header. It was definitely a weekend of meaty headers. But Tottenham seemingly get it done. Vertonghen got a big yellow card that people were screaming should have been a red. Nate, give me your thoughts on this challenge from Vertonghen. I actually don't like him. I think he's a nasty little Belgian who falls down at the slightest puff of wind. I think he's a cheat and he's a stain on English football. But remarkably, they love him at Tottenham. Your thoughts on his meaty challenge?
Meaty challenge. It was a 2-foot lunge that should have had him sent off and banned for 3 matches. And
yeah,
on a weekend,
come on, give it to
that
us straight.
Was plagued. A weekend that was plagued by diving and referees being duped by cheaters of the most flopping, horrible variety. And then this actually escapes with just a yellow. I mean, I think it was so fitting just from the comical weekend that was of officiating that that guy actually gets to stay on for what he did. And, of course, with our beloved gaffer being a Swansea supporter, I noticed World Soccer Talk Twitter feed was pretty flooded with various images of this two-footed lunge that should have been a red card in this match. Thank you to the gaffer for those, because that just further exemplified the fact that this was actually one of the worst decisions of the weekend. And forgive poor Mauricio for the language barrier, because I think in the certain neighborhoods in Buenos Aires, a smash and grab costs you like $25 and a cigarette, and I don't know what exactly goes on during it, but you know, I think it's a different thing down there. So
yes, the finer hostelries of Buenos Aires definitely have the old smash and grab. It's there advertised in the window. Kartik, put a bow on Swansea and Gary Monk, because he's obviously absolutely gutted, and they seem to be getting the rough end of officiating these days.
Yeah, this they had a match against Stoke earlier in the season where they had controversial decisions. Today was a rain plague match. I completely agree. Vertonghen should have been sent off. In fact, I tweeted that. World Soccer Talk retweeted it, and within. There were at least a dozen Spurs fans who came after me. Spurs fans, well, they tend to be very entitled. We know that. We know that they live in terminal jealousy of Arsenal and Chelsea, so many of them. I mean, there's some great Spurs fans out there, some great football men and women that understand the sport, but a large number of them, particularly in the U.S., just have this chip on their shoulder. So any attack on their club, any attack on one of their players, they come after you. Trust me, I've learned this on Twitter for years.
They're Liverpool fans in disguise, if you
ask me. Hey, terminal, by the way, terminal jealousy, that sounds like it could be like the title of a new Drake album. I love it. But no, really, they're the level of luck on the road this year with this team. And I know self-promotion is the best friend of you wanting to slap me, Nick, but I did say that Tottenham was going to go on the road and win this match against Swansea. And I think this is actually their opportunity with their next two fixtures, if I'm not mistaken, being against Leicester and Burnley, where they could actually go on a three-match run, something that many of us said they would never do this entire year. But again, on the road, they're an entirely different team, and it seems that as if luck favors them when they're away from that toxic,
poisonous cesspool known as White Hart Lane. Right?
Indeed.
Crystal Palace versus Stoke. All the action occurred in the first 13 minutes. James McArthur opening up the scoring. Old Peter Crouch. As soon as I take him out of my fantasy team, Crouchy starts scoring again, equalizes. Neil Warnock is saying that he is going to buy next month because they lack a prolific striker. I've got to ask this, Statman, who on earth can Crystal Palace and Neil Warnock afford who's a prolific striker? I love it. Crickets, well, yes.
Fernando Torres.
Well, there's a fella at Rijeka in Croatia who half of Europe is interested in right now, this fella named Andrej Kramaric, who apparently has some clause in his contract where he could be had in January for just 2 million euros, but I don't think he's going to Crystal Palace, but he would be one. He has like 30 goals this season. He's the next Davor Suker. No, I mean, this to me was a result that neither team was pleased with. I mean, Crystal Palace has only one win in the last 10, which came against Liverpool, in fact. And so, you know, they're looking to get 3 points here. And Stoke haven't won two in a row all season. They're trying to string something together here. It's always one step forward, one step back for them. So to me, this was kind of a disappointing result for both sides.
Kartik, Stoke City and Crystal Palace, are they going to be involved in any relegation shenanigans? Or will Stoke City have used their class with Bojan, who, of course, I put in my fantasy team and did nothing, coming to the fore? Palace, it seems like it's, you know, business as usual, relegation battle all season long.
Yeah, Palace is certainly in a relegation battle. Stoke will be fine. I picked Stoke to finish in the top half this season. I think they will. Bojan's come good. It took him a little time.
That's the curse right there.
It took him to acclimate a little bit to England. Sparky's got this team playing some nice football. I think they'll be fine. But Palace hasn't really kicked on under Warnock. I thought they might. Pulis left that team with a good mentality, with some very good players, and they're going to be in this relegation mire all season. And perhaps there'll be three teams worse than them, and they'll survive. But right now, they're just not getting the results they need.
One of those teams
still could... 2 points off of Liverpool, by the way.
Oh, give it a rest. One of those teams could be Burnley. Although they are one of the informed teams, and they got a huge 3 points as Southampton. I mean, oh, they are what do you call them? STP, because they have blown a gasket. Something's wrong with the oil in Southampton. The viscosity, I believe that's how you pronounce it, really isn't happening for Ronald Koeman as they fall to their fourth consecutive defeat. Thomas Heaton, the hero, with a very smart penalty save from Tadic. This Burnley team, Mr. Aburrea, beginning to put some results together, and it's not a foregone conclusion that they will be relegated.
No, I said this weeks ago.
Oh,
I
said that they still have a chance. That there's good... Why don't...
I said this weeks ago. Check the records.
I will.
They had a chance to stay up, and they could be the Cinderella story that everyone wants down there come the end of the year, or they could plummet back down to 20th. There's going to be a clump of five at the end of this year. I think this year there is going to be far more compelling competition down there in the bottom five than the top four, quite frankly. I think the top four is actually going to start developing a little bit of separation from that big bunch of 4-10 parity that we've been looking at for the last few weeks. This relegation fight is going to go down to May. I'm calling it right now, and Burnley could end up anywhere in there. I don't think there's anyone that really has any separation, and we've talked about this with QPR, who has played some of the most attractive football as far as the entire bottom half of the Premier League goes at certain points this year, and have actually, you know, put on real entertaining displays against the likes of Chelsea and Man City and worldwide television affairs, and they're down there with Burnley, and Burnley's played the most archaic caveman football of all time, and this just being a prime example of it. I mean, a penalty save and a nasty deflection for the winner to win 1-0. So, no, anybody could do anything down there. I hope Burnley stays up because of how much everyone seems to hate them and criticize the football they play.
Turf Moor.
Namely that Nick Webster guy.
Turf Moor, one of the finest playing surfaces in all of England. Burnley take on Spurs, Liverpool, Manchester City and Newcastle in their next four Premier League games. Do you know, actually, I've got to go back to a tweet because I missed it. But this is from, let me see, at DarthNator99. Fact of the matter is, if Liverpool beat United on Sunday, the Champions League exit will be completely forgotten. I love it. Sorry, I had to do that, mate.
Oh, well, how'd that end up working out?
Fantastically well. So Burnley, another big 3 points. Southampton, Kartik. I mean, yes, we were expecting them to stub their toe at some point after such an exhilarating start to the season where they played some superb football. I actually watched the game on Monday where I thought they tore United a new one in the first half, but just really couldn't put any of their chances away, and they ended up losing that game to an RVP double. And now they lose to Burnley of all teams, although Burnley were in good form. But where are Southampton going? Can they turn things around under Ronald Koeman? Was this start a mirage? Or are they really a good footballing team that can sustain a challenge, not for Champions League football per se, but maybe for Europa League football and to disrupt this top five?
Well, the league is incredibly bad when you get past the top team or the top two teams this season compared to the other top leagues in Europe. So maybe they can. But quite frankly, this is what they went through last season with a different set of players under Mauricio Pochettino. They started very well. Then they hit a run of matches in November and December where they were playing top teams, where they were playing Chelsea and Manchester City and Arsenal, and almost the same gauntlet that they're facing this year. It was Liverpool last season also. And they lost to them. They've lost Burnley. Is their first loss, which is a head scratcher, right? They've lost to Spurs and Liverpool prior to this run of matches, and now they lost to United, City, and Arsenal all in a row. So
I don't know. It seems like Pella has hit a wall as far as his ability to create and score. Wanyama hasn't played as well. Schneiderlin's injury came at the wrong time for them. And I think they'll be in the top half, but I'm not sure they push for a European spot. I know Birdie is not on the pod today, so I'm not sucking up to him, but I think West Ham, with the squad of players they have, and we'll get to them shortly, they're the outsider that could challenge for a European spot.
You just kind of confessed to your constant sucking up of Birdie, but you did it so quickly and passively that I don't think a lot of people would even notice it.
Yes, we didn't even hear any slurping.
Wasn't that subtle, was it?
Do you have a napkin? No?
I better go get one.
Let's take us off to the Midlands. The Midlands Derby, West Bromwich Albion against Aston Villa. Not the greatest of games, but a typical derby fair, a blood and thunder, highlighted by Kieran Richardson absolutely trying to decapitate Stefan Sessegnon. Statman, this was a much-needed victory for Alan Irvine, who was under increasing pressure. He's obviously relieved that pressure for a week, thumping it all back onto Paul Lambert, who is under increasing pressure. I mean, where do these managers, what do they get up to when they're just under the cosh all the time?
Yeah, and it's very harsh on Alan Irvine because I don't think West Brom have done that poorly now. They have had only 1 point from their previous five, so they were on a bit of a bad run here, but not to the point where he deserved to get sacked. So this result takes a little bit of pressure off of him. And, you know, it was interesting to see Craig Gardner get the goal, who was mouthing off all week about how Aston Villa aren't any bigger of a club than West Brom now. You know, he's going after a club that has a European Cup title and obviously
and a team he used to play for.
Yeah, a team he used to play for and a team that's an ever present in the Premier League. So those were big words, but he backed it up. He got the winner. And go ahead.
No, I'm saying love it. No, keep going, Mossy. Keep going.
That's funny, Mossy, you bring that up because I know a number of Villa fans, and they've dominated the West Midlands. They've been the club in the West Midlands for their entire existence. And that is a fear among Villa fans that I know, that somehow West Brom, just by virtue of staying in the Premier League for a couple seasons, has caught them, and that somehow they're co-equals now. And obviously these clubs are about 5 miles apart or 7 miles apart, so incredible derby match. So what Craig Gardner said, I think, as a former Villa player, hits a note with Villa supporters.
Let's get back to my original question that everybody's ducking. These managers that are under the cosh constantly, they get a win, the pressure's relieved for a week, they lose the next weekend, it's all piled back on. I mean, How do they talk to their players? Because obviously their players are seeing what's going on in the newspapers. They realize that their managers are under intense pressure and very close to getting the sack. How do these managers go about talking to their players and giving the impression that they really don't give a toss? Because, you know, if you go into the changing room and you're in fear of your job, you're going to pass that on to your players, Kartik.
Yeah, and I agree with Mossy on Alan Irvine. I actually was telling a local pub owner who's a West Brom supporter a couple weeks ago when I went into his pub that I was impressed by Irvine because tactically, to me, he was getting the most out of the low level of players he has. I mean, their budget is below that even of the newly promoted teams, with the exception of Burnley. So I've been impressed by him. I don't know how these managers do it. With Lambert, he's been under pressure since the minute he took that job, the minute he was appointed. And has managed to survive, partly because I think Randy Lerner is disinterested and doesn't want to pay to bring in a new manager. I don't know how they do it. You're beginning to get the sense that a guy like Brendan Rodgers, who is in a real pressure cooker right now, is beginning to crack with some of his decisions, making rash tactical changes. I know we covered that match already, but rash tactical decisions, saying some bizarre things in press conferences or some very, I think, defensive things. In press conferences and post-match comments. So I don't know how these managers do it, especially considering players are always seemingly auditioning either for the shop window or for the next manager who's coming in.
Well, how has Arsene Wenger done it for the last damn near a decade, it seems like. I mean, that's actually really shines a very interesting light on the Frenchman there, because we've talked about the revolving cycle,
Nate,
that is Arsenal Football
Wenger,
Club. How does he pull it off?
Wenger has pictures of you with a donkey. That's how he's managed to pull it off.
He has pictures of the board with two donkeys in an alleyway in Buenos Aires getting a smash and grab for $25.
Smash and grab. I love it.
It goes with the oily massage.
Got two managers under pressure, Gus Poyet and, not anymore, Sam Allardyce. Sam Allardyce, who was actually favourite for the sack race when the season began, buoyant now as they ride high in fourth place and a Champions League spot. Yes, Bertie, you can raise a glass of Chardonnay. They took their wares off to the Stadium of Light, and I'm sure Andy Carroll got a very sweet reception from the Black Cat supporters. Both teams, I think, are probably happy with a point. Sunderland going through a dodgy period where they're just scratching around. West Ham United flying high, and but a point on the road is always very good. Jordi Gomez opened up the scoring for the Black Cats. Stuart Downing, who is coming into some kind of England form, replying for the Hammers. Let's start with you, Statman. When we look at Sunderland and their free fall down the table, and let's start with Josie Altidore, because I know the NBC boys were pretty cruel. Their one highlight after the goal of Sunderland was to show Josie, you can't even really call it a miss, because he didn't even get himself in a position to miss it. Do you remember the cross I'm referring to from the right-hand side, and Jose all alone in the six-yard box, and somehow it's even baffling me now what he actually did, but he did nothing when he should have scored.
No, yeah, that was a terrible miss, and then they had another great chance late. Connor Wickham was denied by Adrian. So, yeah, this is another 2 points I'm sure Poyet feels like were dropped. And, yeah, they've drawn 5 of their last 6, Nick, and 10 of 16 this season. The record for draws in a 38-match season is 17. Newcastle did it once, and Villa did it a couple more times. So that record is well within sight. They're beginning to remind me of Mark Hughes' Man City teams. I'm sure Cardick remembers
yes.
that.
But, we drew 7 matches in a row that season. Seriously.
But no, so they need to start getting some wins here. Although, you know, when you're in a relegation battle, a point every week, I mean, against the teams they're competing with, they're actually gaining ground. So... they want to distance themselves further from that drop zone, so they do need to turn a couple of these draws into wins here.
To that point, Statman, though, I was speaking to somebody who's quite in the know in the Premiership. I'm not going to give his name away because he'd be pretty pissed off with me, but he said to me that he thinks that 38 points this year could be safe, and the conventional wisdom is 40 in the Premiership. I'll go back to you, Stat, because you love the numbers. 38. What do you think about that? A point a game, safety in the Premiership this season.
It could be. Now, Burnley was a team that weeks ago we thought for sure was going to put up some ridiculously low number, and they've even gotten back into a respectable place. They're not even in the relegation zone at the moment. So I don't know. I mean, you've got Leicester at 10, Hull at 13, QPR at 14 right now. QPR is still to play in this round, but... it's possible, yeah, that 38 could keep you up. I mean, I don't see any of those three teams I just mentioned really getting on much of a roll here until the end of the season. So, yeah, it's probably going to be a low number this season.
Nate, do the Hammers stay in Champions League contention, or will the old saying, and I don't know if you know this one, but the saying is that West Ham go down when you take down the Christmas decorations. So... Come January, come February, West Ham United, and this is notorious that they start plummeting down the table.
No, I'll give them till February to start doing that. I think they'll carry on for another month up there. Southampton are the team in plummet right now, and I mean the Hammers are riding. I mean, talk about agony for Liverpool supporters all over the world right now. They're riding Andy Carroll and Stuart Downing to 6 points over the last couple of weeks into a Champions League spot. I mean, the pain of watching that is just hilarious. But no, I don't actually see their run ending. I don't see them finishing in the top four. Not even Birdie has said that he expects them to finish in the top four and that they're going to be in Champions League position come April and May.
I think if you've asked Bertie after he's had a nice California Chardonnay, that tune soon changes.
Well, you have asked me after a few Sierra Nevada Imperial Stout Narwhals if I thought Liverpool was going to make the Champions League, and I still say yes. So I think that's a product of alcoholism at its finest there. We all know they're not going to finish in the top four. However, I think they could stay in a top four or five position for another couple of months. And I know I've thrown out a couple of correct predictions from yours truly in the spot. I have to go back to one actually on one of the first of the season where I said that Sam Allardyce would be fired by October. So he has blown away a lot of people and shut a lot of people up, and they've played multiple styles of football. And that's something that the Fat Man has actually made some very good points on recently with Andy Carroll coming back, that it hasn't, destroyed their beautiful style that was kind of electrifying people's eyes. It hasn't destroyed it. It's added a new layer to them as a team and gives them a new way to win if they need it. The fact that they are a diversely cultured team on the field, I mean, that's huge in terms of staying in, who knows, staying in a Europa League spot as this bunch of parity progresses through this 2014-2015 season, because they can play multiple styles well. There's not a lot of teams that can play one style well. So, I mean, that's a huge factor in Allardyce keeping that team where it could potentially be, which I see, who knows, could be fifth or sixth place, quite frankly.
Well, frankly, quite frankly, I'm just relieved that Andy Carroll is in the English Premiership. The Premiership needs a blood and thunder centre-forward type. All this, you know, fancy foreigner larking around Sergio Aguero nonsense. I mean, it's just too much. You know, you need that kind of centre-forward that can rise majestically and just batter headers into the back of the net while kicking up centre-halves in the backside. It's absolutely perfect in my book. Long live Andy Carroll. And I hope he continues to threaten and terrify Premiership backlines for many, many years to come. Moving on, Chelsea. Gary Cahill, you cheating bastard. That's all I've got to say about this game. What a cheating bastard. And Chris Foy, you're a cheating bastard as well for not sending off Gary Cahill. We are talking about Chelsea against Hull. Gary Cahill, already on a yellow card, goes storming into the Hull City penalty area and falls down over a blade of grass. No yellow card for Mr. Cahill. And of course, Chelsea take complete advantage. Eden Hazard had already opened up the scoring. But Hull were giving Chelsea, I think, a very good game. And this is where the inconsistency of it all really pisses me off with Chris Foy, is that Diego Costa then picked up a yellow card, and I actually thought that it looked like Costa was fouled and he wasn't even trying to simulate a dive or a foul or that he'd been not touched. I mean, it was obvious to me that Costa was just trying to play the game of football and he picked up a yellow card. So Chris Foy really spoiled it for me, although he did get it right when Tom Hoddleston went, "I'm going to have you," and absolutely done William, if I'm not mistaken. But let's talk about the performance of Chris Foy before we move on to Chelsea Kartik. Did the referee spoil the game for you?
Yes. He was terrible. And Chris Foy has been a good Premier League official for a number of years, but he's had a number of these sorts of matches this season. He got the Huddleston decision right. No doubt about that, but he missed two or three bookable offenses from Gary Cahill, and obviously the Costa incident speaks for itself, as you mentioned, Nick. So he had a bit of a shocker. Steve Bruce was all over him in the post game, and probably rightfully so.
Statman, what did you make of Jose Mourinho and Steve Bruce having like a little cuddle, little chat as the game was winding down? What do you think? What do you think he was saying to Steve Bruce?
Well, I mean, he did come out in defense of Cahill afterwards and publicly and say that he didn't dive. But I don't know, maybe he went over to Bruce and said, "Hey, listen, I'd be upset if I were you too." Yeah, I mean, those are some tough calls that went against you today. So I don't know. I don't know what Mourinho says in those chats, frankly. I know some managers don't appreciate that he walks over before the game's over, and others don't seem to mind it. But,
I just think it's the cheekiest thing in the world. You know, you're 2-0 up. Obviously, Chelsea are not going to let the game go. I mean, the nerve of Mourinho. I mean, how does he get away with it? Why doesn't a manager turn around and chin him? Why doesn't a manager go all Alan Pardew, nut Mourinho, and then follow it up with, take that, you effing Portuguese, see you next Tuesday, as he did to Arsene Wenger one time.
But you know, it wasn't a great Chelsea performance, and it's funny because there seems to be this trend in world football now where the top managers, they don't want these big squads. They're sort of shortening the rotation, so to speak, and going with 15 or so players and trotting out the same 11s week in, week out. And I know Mourinho's done that with Chelsea this season. And, you know, there's a lot of concern in Madrid that Ancelotti's done that, and the team's starting to get tired as a result and starting to pick up some niggling injuries here and there because of muscle fatigue and whatnot. And, you know, I wonder if that's going to start creeping in with Chelsea here, especially during this busy holiday period, because the same players have played a lot of matches here, and they're starting to look not quite as sharp as they did earlier in the season. And you know, they're still sort of grinding out enough results. I mean, as Mourinho keeps reminding everybody, they're still at the top of the table. He always says they wouldn't trade place with anybody. But I don't know if that's true because, you know, they're a team that might have peaked already. And while City haven't played close to their best football yet, and they're only 3 points back. So I'm not sure which team's position you'd rather be in right now.
There's a great quote from Jose Mourinho. He says, Mr. Foy, come and tell the guys, please. Diego is crying in the dressing room because you gave him a yellow card. And these guys are asking why. So supposedly Foy was rather embarrassed, but eventually drew a handkerchief from his pocket, giving it to Mourinho.
Right, but I mean, look, we're focusing so much on his in-game activity, and I think that's such a statement of this backlash of how to defeat diving as an action in the English Premier League, and how this whole attitude of he overreacted because he knew he blew one, and then he gives a yellow to Costa for simulation on something where he was quite frankly fouled and was playing the game. And it goes back to something that you and I, Nick, have talked about on this pod, off the air, a million times, and that is that if you want to stamp out the type of diving that was on display throughout this match and throughout this entire weekend, you got to treat it like violent conduct. You can't have that immediate rash reaction to it, because that creates situations like Costa getting a yellow card. You got to give Gary Cahill a 3-match ban. You have to give him a 3-match ban. You have to treat this as violent conduct, looking at it on video in the days after the match. You can't put the responsibility on the referee himself to do it. Yeah, it was egregious, but this is something where the FA has to take a bold stand and say, we cannot put up with this. This is what plagues our game. Is games and weekends like this. And this, I texted you during this. I said, this game, Chelsea and Hull, has exemplified more than any other that I've seen this season, everything beautiful about modern football and everything wrong with it. This was terrible.
Oh, absolutely terrible. I agree with you 100% there, Nate Aburrea. I mean, it always pisses me off when you see a referee imposing his personality on a game that really has nothing to do with him. But Chelsea, remorseless, just grinding away. More trouble for Steve Bruce and Hull. They've got to figure out a way how to start winning games and getting 3 points. No one will stop this blue machine. Talking of blue machines, Kartik's Manchester City grinding one out at the King Power Stadium against the worst team in the Premiership. Super Frank Lampard, soon to be NYCFC bound, or perhaps not.
Maybe not.
With the only goal of the game. But once again, injuries popping up for City. But it has been a good week for City. Obviously, the victory in Rome, taking them through to the knockout stages of the Champions League. But injuries. Vincent Kompany and his tight little hamstring. It's got to be a concern when the backup is Mangala, who, even though he played well against Leicester, has been rather poor recently.
Yeah, and I think this is something that's been happening with Vincent company the last few seasons, beginning the year after the initial title win, where he's getting injured a lot. These hamstring injuries tend to be nagging injuries. Nastasic had to play a lot that following season. He had just signed with the club at the age of 19. He did quite well, actually, that year. But now you're seeing Mangala having to be rushed in. Even saw Dedrick Boyata get a Premier League start in the match at Sunderland a few weeks ago because of the lack of availability of company. So this is a concern, and the injuries have mounted for City this season. But again, Frank Lampard, he's made a living on spot runs, late runs into the area, just timing his presence in the box to perfection. And a lot of times it's, in the Chelsea years, it was based on making late runs on counterattacks. With City this season, it's been making starting a move, continuing his run, ghosting into the area, defenders losing him, and him getting decisive goals. And that's his fourth Premier League goal this season for City, his sixth in all competitions. And it's going to be very interesting these next couple of weeks to see what happens between Major League Soccer and Manchester City, because Pellegrini clearly does not want him to leave the club until the end of the season.
Statman, you've obviously got a vested interest in Frank Lampard coming to Major League Soccer, seeing that Fox has a deal to show some of the games. Will Frank Lampard be arriving come March time? I don't think so, and neither does many of the panel on the Champions League show, namely Wijnaldum and Barton.
Yeah, I don't think so either. I think what's unique about this situation is that Man City actually own the MLS club in question, so they should have a say on when he departs. So, yeah, I mean, this was a bad week for NYFC because NYCFC, I'm sorry. Because, you know, had they
gotten on ESPN and MLS, yes.
had they gone out of the Champions League, I think then that would have diffused a lot of this. But no, I mean, as long as they're still in that competition, and obviously they've closed on Chelsea here in the league, I mean, there's no way that come February when, you know, you're right in the thick of it here, the business end of the season, as they say, he's going to want to go play preseason games for New York. So, yeah, no, I think that's going to be an issue, and he's going to end up staying longer than initially agreed upon. And one note on Lampard, it was Premier League goal number 175 equals Thierry Henry. He's only got Rooney, Andy Cole, and Alan Shearer above him. So incredible honor for a midfielder.
Nice. Hey, NYCFC, real quick. I mean, we've rumored, we've whispered the words Beckham Part 2 kind of as a joking thing. And my opinion is that Frank Lampard will play for NYCFC come June. He's going to get a month off at the end of a fantastic season where he's scoring meaningful goals for a second-place team in the English Premier League. I think he's still coming in June. Well, now, with the form that he's in, that almost comes into question of, God, is this Beckham Part 2? I don't know anymore.
Of course it's Beckham Part 2. I mean, it just goes to show the...
I mean, that lingering on for, like, a couple years, you know what I mean? Like, this isn't just going to sort itself out come the end of the Premier League season or the end of the Champions League. This could kind of Frank Lampard look himself in the mirror and go, damn, I didn't realize I had this much left.
The one thing that's different about Beckham, though, is Lampard has retired from England. Remember, Beckham at the time still wanted to stay in the picture for England, and that's what created a lot of the trouble because Capello basically
right.
told him, as long as you're in MLS, I'm not going to call you up. So
yeah.
So this situation might be a little bit different. But no, I mean, it is, you know, it is tough when a player, you're right, he signs with MLS, he kind of thinks he's at a certain level in his career, and then he sort of sees evidence that, no, I could still be playing at a very high level. So it's tough psychologically to wrap your head around going to MLS when you think you could still be competing at a higher level than that.
Well, and why would you want to play in MLS with a bunch of, you know, super fit athletic bruisers? Because that's basically what MLS is in the, how would you call the season that they play before they actually start playing?
Right.
What do they
the
call
regular
that?
Season.
What do they call that season?
The regular season.
Oh, the regular season. Yes, the regular season. I mean, having just watched the MLS playoffs and thoroughly enjoyed them, I just can't see the likes of a Frank Lampard enjoying the regular season where players are really going through the motions in some games. The amount of travel that's going to be put on his aging body, I mean, it just doesn't seem to make any sense. And until, you know, MLS can play every game with the kind of intensity that you see in the playoffs. What's the attraction other than money for these aging superstars who already have a ton of money, Nate?
There's none. I mean, the league needs fixing, and if we're going to go to 24 teams, I mean, you talk about, hey, you're talking to a panel of three Americans right here, and I mean, my take is if you're going to go to 24 teams in this league, you need to fix the whole structure, because these playoffs are, I mean, they actually attract attention from people. A lot of people might not believe the statement that I'm about to say, but actually attract a little bit of worldwide attention because they are so intense. They are actually so intriguing to watch. And until you can figure out a way to spread those 3 weeks into the god-awful MLS regular season, then this league's never going to make it, and you're destined to be the Roman Empire and get far too big and end up killing yourself as a result. I will throw this one last thing out to put a bow on this MLS talk. How about the rumors of Bradley Wright Phillips and Jermaine Defoe being scooped up by QPR in January?
I can't even remember who won the regular season in MLS.
Who cares? It doesn't matter. Right. I mean, as a San Jose Earthquake supporter, now you're hitting a real hard, the just painful core right now, the amount of times that the Earthquakes have been the best team in MLS and have won the Supporters' Shield. And one time I had my team jacked away and taken off to Houston to then win the next two MLS Cups. And the other time we were knocked out by the Galaxy in the first round of the playoffs. The regular season is a fraud in this country. It's a big money-making milker. They play international friendlies throughout that joke of a regular season. All they care about is the playoffs, and they know that if they can get two of their big market teams into those playoffs, then it's going to be a success internationally. Don Garber is a fraud. You are a fraud. Hashtag Garber fraud.
The man did just recover from cancer, I believe. So,
fraud.
Nate Abudea, displaying his usual compassion.
Hashtag compassion.
Who said this? And I'll answer it anyway. There's only one Arsene Wenger. One Arsene Wenger. That would be the schizophrenic Arsenal fans at the Emirates Stadium as they put together the finest performance of the weekend, absolutely taking Newcastle United to the cleaners, courtesy of Oliver Giroud with, I'd love to call it, a meaty header and one delightful finish, and Cozzola with two very stunning finishes, one from open play and the other, well, you know how they go. The little chip from the penalty. Very, very cheeky. Arsene Wenger coming back from what was obviously a very tough loss last weekend against Stoke City, where we absolutely lambasted him for a very shoddy performance, and then his own supporters just basically abused him at Stoke City train station. They get a great victory during the midweek in the Champions League at Galatasaray. Unfortunately, Aaron Ramsey and his very tight hamstrings pinging again, so they'll be missing the influential Welshman for some time, as well as my old favourite, my English boy who loves a cigarette or two. Names need not be said. But let's talk about Arsenal for a minute, Statman. Very, very entertaining performance. Sanchez, for me, was the man who pulled the strings. Without doubt, the finest buy in England this year.
Yeah, and Arsenal do have quite a bit of firepower now in that three-pronged attack of Sanchez, Welbeck, and Giroud. I mean, you know, they're a team that tends to lack a little bit of a cutting edge sometimes, play a lot of neat soccer in the midfield, but maybe lack something up front. And now it's gone the other way. I mean, they're almost reverting to a bit of a more direct style, but they have all of a sudden a lot of guys that can put the ball in the back of the net. So, yeah, you know, I know there were questions with Giroud coming back about what that would mean for Welbeck, you know, having to move out wide a little bit, which is something he didn't like at United, and part of the reason he came to Arsenal was to play in the middle. But Wenger, I think, has been able to keep everybody happy there and on the same page. And, yeah, like you said, big week for Arsenal, 8 goals in 2 games. So they've gotten themselves somewhat back on track here, heading into a showdown at Anfield next week.
A showdown at Anfield, Nate. How is Arsenal going to cope with this just Liverpool-destroying machine?
Well, I'll show my usual Nate Abarea compassion and wish a little long-running Tottenham karma back on Arsenal, and maybe all their players will get food poisoning before the match, and that'll be Liverpool's only hope.
Arsenal have QPR after the Liverpool game. West Ham United, so not a lot of traveling. Southampton, and then they will repeat the FA Cup against Hull City. Kartik, looks like the fixture list is rounding out nicely for the Gunners, and perhaps this Arsene Wenger out will be Arsene Wenger in should they take 9 points and move themselves up into that top four position.
This seems to be an annual rite of passage for Arsenal. I think it's very, very telling every single season when the Arsenal fans, when the Gunner faithful begin jumping down Arsene Wenger's back, they get a run of form, generally against weak opposition, 3, 4, 5 wins on the trot, and then it all goes away just to start back up again in February or March. So I think we're at that point this season. They're going to take 9 of 9 or 12 of 12, something like that, 10 of 12 in the over the festive period, and they'll be silenced for a little while, and then they'll be back once they fall by the wayside against the likes of Chelsea and Manchester United and Manchester City.
Talking of being silenced, Alan Pardew named the manager of the month for November. His side will now take on Tottenham at the Lane, Sunderland in the derby, Manchester United and Everton. Hashtag Pardew out by the end of December, Nate.
I mean, go back to week 2 or 3 in this season. Who were the managers that I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but Alan Pardew and Sam Allardyce were the two that were most rumored on this show, in the British tabloids, around the world as being the ones that were going to get the sack earliest in this season. And I mean, we just absolutely shit all over Tottenham supporters going right, staying there in North London real quick with their attitude towards Pochettino and being so inconsistent. I mean, look at Arsene Wenger being able to go from 1 week to the next as a manager, getting booed off with them, holding a banner saying fire Wenger now or sack Wenger now, whatever the heck it said, to them singing his name 7 days later. No, Pardew, yeah, hashtag Pardew out. What does anybody know? Managers, it's absurd the level of inconsistency in terms of support from fan bases these days and owners as well. I mean, no one knows what's coming.
Statman, put a bow on this weekend, will ya?
Well, it's exciting to have a race at the top again. City managing to keep pace with Chelsea for one more weekend. And like I said, I think the top four is pretty well defined now. I think it's going to be Man City, Chelsea, United, and Arsenal, I think, are clearly the four best teams.
Oh, you're putting United in there? Disgusting. Kartik, set him right, please.
Oh, I can't, unfortunately. I think the top four, I was having this conversation with someone before I jumped on the show. The top four it seems more set this season than it's been since the years of the Big Four, when we knew who the top four were going to be, but we just didn't know the order. I think it's probably Chelsea, Man City, Man United, Arsenal in that order. But here's the topping on the weekend. As poorly as they played, as bad as they've been at the Lane, Spurs are only 2 points behind Arsenal. Now, can you believe that?
Nate Aburea.
The stat man has called De Gea at Man United the second best goalkeeper in the world. And this Liverpool-Man United match was painful to watch for a number of reasons as a Liverpool supporter. But I had a very, very surreal almost feeling of deja vu as the relationship for 90 minutes between Raheem Sterling and David De Gea reminded me oh so much of that of Landon Donovan to Oliver Kahn in the 2002 World Cup quarterfinal in South Korea. I mean, some of the same spots on the pitch where left-footed 1v1 with the keeper misses would come. For anyone interested in watching both of those, you'll see what I'm referring to. It was tough, and David De Gea is going to haunt Raheem Sterling for quite some time after this weekend. 20 matches now for club and country without a goal for that Mr. Razzle-Dazzle electrifying Raheem Sterling. I hope he gets off the snide soon, because that's the type of thing that could really start to wear on a young player. Raheem, we wish you all the best. Get on back. Liverpool needs you. Darth Nader 99 for all of your Don Garber compassion, hate mail, and anybody else in the Premier League who wants to give me anything.
I know you love the Don. For myself, being a Londoner, good weekend for a Londoner and London clubs. Arsenal trouncing the Magpies. Very sweet. Tottenham getting out of jail. West Ham United, a point on the road. Chelsea, even though that cheating bastard Cahill really put a sour taste in the mouth. And Crystal Palace getting some results. And tomorrow, come on you Hoops, come on you Rs. QPR will get the 3 points and move out of the relegation zone. For Nate Aburea, the stat man, David Mossy, and Kartik Karishnaya, I am Nick Webster, at Nick Webster. We'll catch you all next week when we bring you the Barclays Premier League on the World Soccer Talk Pod. Hashtag WST Pod. See you next week.